Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I just lost a whole morning watching a video of a squirrel slowly getting drunk eating fermented pears. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I can safely say I'm more focused than a wobbly rodent here on Big Squid. Today's show, Ben Elwood returns for our second-to-last Christopher Nolan rewatch as we cover Dunkirk. I kind of can't believe we're up to the second-to-last movie. Like, I knew we were. Like, it's not that much of a surprise. But to say it out loud is like, oh, God, yeah, we're finally kind of getting there. That means Tenet is not too far away. So remember, we've been giving you time to see it, specifically people in places that haven't had the opportunity. We're thinking of you, Melbourne. So fingers crossed you've had time to check it out and you'll be able to listen to that podcast and not have to worry that you might start listening and then suddenly think, hang on a sec, I haven't checked it out. Anyway, that's coming up soon, but today is Dunkirk and we have some surprising thoughts on this remarkable film. So keep your ears and mind open for that. I've also been listening to the new Elvis Costello album, Hey Clockface, and have some thoughts I'll share with you about his new album. First, some gig news. Actually, lots of gig news. There's been a lot of gigs recently, and there's some gigs coming up. Let's start with our second live Big Squid show on December 13. This one is our version of a Christmas gathering we've called FOMUS. If you prefer to celebrate the birth of Baby Yoda over Baby Jesus, then this is the show for you. We have a few guests returning from last time, including Richard Feidler, Georgia Mooney, Cal Wilson, and Ben Elwood. And we also have some new guests, including Alice Fraser, Alex Jay, and Rove McManus. We have some fun ideas lined up for you. So if you're keen to check it out, you can go to giantdwarf.com.au to buy tickets to see us in the flesh or watch online from anywhere in the world. The show is 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Initially, it said 5 p.m., but it got changed to 6 p.m. and that was because of daylight savings in Australia. So I'm hoping for everyone who's overseas that hasn't mucked you around too much. It kind of took me by surprise. There were some emails back and forth and I've been writing for the Actors Awards and a few other little projects and it kind of got lost in the mix a little bit. But anyway, that's what's happened, and that's why it's at 6 p.m. So I hope it hasn't mucked you around. For people in Australia, it feels like it's the old school countdown time slot, doesn't it? So hopefully that'll give you an idea of what mood you should be in when you sit down to watch us or come and visit us. These shows are relatively expensive to produce, so if you'd like to encourage any friends to check it out, I'd love to get some extra eyes on this. We had good numbers last time, and we need to keep building and just make it a little bit bigger. Get a few more people in there. Between you and me, I'm actually hoping to build this into the type of show which we could do like a, I don't know, like a 4 to 6 week season. Would you be into that? I feel like if it's like a little season of it, then we can play around with the format and we can do some things. And it might be fun to have a show that you can check in with that isn't on a network. So that could be fun. But anyway, it's baby steps for the moment, and any help you'd be able to throw our way by bringing people in is greatly appreciated. God, you wouldn't want to put it on a network, would you? Yeah, they would just butcher it. What are you talking about? Why are you talking about these things? Why don't you get an ex-rugby player to do some wacky stunt? That will get the punters in. Will it? Probably not the right punters. Anyway, December 13, Big Squid Fomus. We'd love to have you and your friends drop in. As for stand-up gigs, I just finished one in Newcastle with Tom Gleason, and that was a lot of fun. Newcastle's always great. It's a beautiful theatre there. My God, it's so stunning. I performed there for the first time, I think maybe back in 2004 as part of the Melbourne Comedy Festival Roadshow. And it's a real treat to go back and perform to everyone in Newcastle and be on that beautiful stage. So I'm performing again for the last time this year with Tom Gleason on December 4th at the Sydney Opera House. So Tom's show is fantastic, and if you'd like to come along, we'd love to see you. And then on December 5th, if you're out Orange Way, I'm performing at Grapes of Mirth with a bevy of good mates, including Dilja Singer, Cam James, Beck Charleswood, Nazim Hussain, Chris Ryan and Merrick Watts. These gigs are a lot of fun, and if you'd like to check it out, head to grapesofmirth.com.au. And then finally, for my hometown Adelaide, I will be back at the Rhino Room on the 18th of December with support act Suraj Kolhatkar. So it'll be nice to get back to the Rhino Room. Feels like I was there in March, and it feels like 107 years ago. So I think that might be their last show for the year. Numbers are small. Well, they're not small, but, you know, they just have to be careful with all of the restrictions, etc. So you might want to get onto that quickly if you're keen to check it out. You can find details for that at adelaidecomedy.com. I reckon if we maybe sell out the first one, I think it's early. We might be able to put on a second one, but don't plan on a second one. That would be my hint. Anyway, so many shows. What is happening here? This almost feels normal. We're very lucky in Australia. Hopefully we don't find it too normal. I want everyone to keep disinfecting their hands and being very careful. I want everyone to keep being safe. But we're very lucky to be in a position to perform again. And I don't want to take that lightly. And I don't want to take that for granted, especially with friends all over the world in all sorts of deep lockdown. But if you can make it, it'd be great, and please come up and say hello. Okay, let's have a chat about Elvis Costello's new album, Hey Clockface. The first song I ever encountered from Elvis was Oliver's Army, a song that would often just pop into my head out of nowhere and hang around for a day or two before disappearing again. Like, when I first encountered that song, I was really young. And so I didn't quite have the disposable income to just go out and buy an album. I had to be very specific. I had to, you know, ask people to do it for me. But it was a song that would just kind of sit in the back of my head for days on end. And then you'd forget about it. And then you'd be sitting there thinking, oh, what's that tune? And then you'd realize who it was, or, you know, there'd be a lyric that would spark the rest of the song to kind of fully form in your memory and imagination. I was really into it. And basically, if I wanted to hear it again, I had to wait for it to turn up on radio or on the Australian TV show Countdown. We've mentioned Countdown before. For people overseas, if you don't know what Countdown is, type into YouTube, Molly Meldrum, Countdown, and on behalf of Australia, you're welcome. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's really worthwhile checking out. But anyway, when I became a teenager, I was listening to the radio one day, and then I heard the song, I Want You. I loved it so much, and it felt like something new compared to the power pop of Oliver's Army. I had a little bit of spending money, so I went to a record store and I bought the album that song was on, which was Blood and Chocolate, and Elvis became one of my favourite artists. Costello has always been an amazing musician and is underrated in a way. He often bounces around genres, as definitely as Bowie, and his growth from the punk days to his elder statesman status has been fascinating to watch. I have to admit, I haven't loved all of his albums, but not because I think they're bad, but sometimes he just plays in genres and styles that I'm not necessarily that interested in. But I always give his new albums a couple of goes before I make up my mind, and I'm rapt to say that his new album, Hey Clockface, is fantastic. Elvis is 66 now, but the fire still burns in his belly, and the first single, No Flag, returns to his punk roots. It's a song that rolls along to a thunderous beat with a lyric that could be about the end of a failed relationship against the backdrop of a world decaying politically. Costello has said in interviews that he sang live on the studio floor, and the musicians weren't afraid to play loud and jagged or intimate and beautiful. Have a little taste of No Flag. When Costello says he wasn't afraid to play jagged, you can hear the fuzziness of the song on the edges, making it vibrant and dangerous. This is an album that feels to me like it would fit in well amongst his run of albums that include Blood and Chocolate, Spike, Mighty Like a Rose, and Brutal Youth. I loved those albums because they didn't really follow the path you expected. Every song kind of stood alone, but as a whole, it still held together. It's amazing to kind of listen back to them and witness that and kind of experience it. And this album is no different. Check out the spoken word timelessness of Radio Is Everything. It's a song that can, I feel like it can only be truly appreciated if you've come home from a long day of work, you've put your feet up on the lounge as the sun has nearly set and the shadows have invaded your home. I Do, Zula's song, feels like it could accompany an episode of Perry Mason, a battered suit that covers a coffee-stained white shirt with a lipstick stain fading on the collar. While The Last Confession of Vivian Whipp recalls the album North and the work Costello made there. As I said earlier, Elvis has always been eclectic and a fascinating artist. I love his use of words, his desire to march to his own beat, and as he grows older, it is inspiring to know he hasn't become wearier. He's still as whip-smart as anyone in the game and refuses to rest on his laurels. Hey Clockface sounds like the album of an artist who has done it all, but refuses to look backwards when the future still holds so much mystery to explore. In May and June of 1940, the German armies had managed to trap 400,000 English, French, and Allied soldiers in a town where the only way they can escape is by sea. The problem is that Germany owns the skies and bombs the warships that try to save the soldiers on the beach. They drop pamphlets from the sky that terrorize the young men who desperately want to escape. But even though they can almost see home, they will need a miracle to return. This is the story of Dunkirk.
What has happened is a colossal military disaster. We shall go on to the end. We shall never surrender.
The call went out. We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
One of ours.
He's on me.
I'm on him.
The ship's about to leave.
Down you go.
They need to send more ships. Every hour the enemy pushes closer. They've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
We or they will die.
You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
You should be at home.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Turn it around!
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall never surrender.
We shall never surrender. We shall never surrender.
Where's the bloody Air Force?
I had a different opening question for you in mind, but as I was writing this up, you know, we are at this point a few days after Joe Biden winning the US election, and I rewatched this movie while the election was still up in the air, and it kind of left a certain resonance about people from back in history and where we are today, and I was wondering, what were you feeling watching this movie? In the present climate,
it's funny you say that because you know I think you could I think some people have argued that maybe the last couple of minutes of this movie is a little hokey or sentimental, and I think that's not necessarily true. I think that's in contrast with everything, you know, the 90 minute fucking anxiety attack that's preceded it. That when we finally slow down and go, oh, you know, hey, people care about each other. It's not jarring, but it's definitely a tonal shift from But I did have that moment where all the yachts and the boats arrive at Dunkirk, and it is so rousing and beautiful. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, you know, these day sailors are risking their lives to help out. And I did have a moment where I was like, I don't know, this would happen today. I'm not sure it would happen on this scale today. I think the politics of the day, and hopefully that's what's changing now. Hopefully Trump losing is a repudiation in the main of cruelty and selfishness and all the rest. But definitely between the years 2015 and 2020, I'm not sure that had they summoned a whole bunch of people to help out, that maybe it would have. I don't know.
It does make you wonder if it's like, you're not taking my boat.
Yeah.
I paid good money for that.
Yeah, well, when
it's not my kid.
Yeah, yeah. When Mike Rylance is dragging all those sailors covered in oil in, I'm thinking, oh my God, the upholstery of his boat's fucked now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the sequel to Dunkirk, is an hour 40 of him trying to clean shit up.
Yeah. And yeah, I wonder if that kind of self-serving mentality would take precedence over, fuck, I need to, you know, really go and risk something. There just seems like the sense of, I think the Trump era and Trump and everything is a real kind of doubling down on that idea of rugged individualism and me, and that communal spirit, which has been demonized by the labels of socialism and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's got a dirty kind of ring to it now in the discourse.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could rouse people on that level to be so self-sacrificial.
It's a really good question, and I make this next joke knowing full well that we all suffer from this on a certain level. But I could imagine now, you know, we're going to need your boat. It's like, look, I have to be honest, I'm feeling quite anxious, and I just need to share my feelings. And today's not good.
Yeah.
Can we do it tomorrow? It's funny the idea of the ending being hokey, because not everything quite works out.
Yeah.
Like, I've got this in the facts later on, but the movie ends and the next 4 years of Farrier's life are fucked.
Totally.
And he maybe never sees England again.
Totally.
And Harry Styles' character is a kind of interesting character because he reveals himself to be quite xenophobic and lacking empathy. Mm-hmm. And the reason he is those things is because he feels this immense guilt. And there is a scene when they're on the boat and they're covered in the oil.
Yep.
And Tommy looks over at him and he looks ashamed.
Yep.
And then that's not even taking into account once he's on the train and how he can't even bear to read what's in the paper.
Yep.
So I don't think it's hokey at all. Like the poor Scottish pilot when they get in and who gets yelled at, you know, that some more facts coming up a little bit later. You know, that was something that actually happened, and I don't think it's hokey at all, and I don't actually think it's sentimental, but I think it's a word that you used earlier on, which is you see a level of decency
yes.
that we now mistake for hokey or sentimental.
Yes, I think that's the point. And I think it's really interesting that that thing you said about Harry Styles, the moment where he's ashamed of it, and it's a clear shot where he looks down. And I really read that as, you know, I mean, it's obviously not designed in this way because it was made before all this started, but I think... it's a real, that one moment is almost like a total indictment of the idea that you can hector and shame someone into having a conscience.
Yes.
I think, sorry, what's the young guy? The
main one that we follow? That's Tommy.
Okay, so Tommy, you know, I think if Tommy had like stormed up to Harry Styles in that boat and gone, you piece of shit, you're a fucking... asshole, you let him drown, da, 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 that would start this whole ratcheting up of like, well, no, fuck you, I was, you know, doing what I had to do. The fact that he just looked at him and like a human being, you know, it's just almost like an agnostic look that he gives him, because it's the look of, there's a slight bit of like, hey man, you're a fucking asshole,
right.
But I also understand we were under major duress and in a crazy situation, and instead of succumbing to your better angels, you succumb to your worst. And but who am I to judge? Because fuck, man, this is a crazy moment that we're all stuck in. And I think it's that lack of condemnation from Tommy that makes Harry Styles actually look at himself for a minute. And I think that's a lesson that we could all take into this brave new world that we live in.
Yes.
That maybe getting up in people's faces is not... People double down, they start yelling, and then it just turns into a shit fight where nothing is actually heard.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think you should ever tolerate the intolerant.
No.
But I also don't think using the weapons and the game plan of the conservative, nasty political right is actually helpful to the left-wing cause.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's about...
or even the moderate cause.
No. And I think the only way is to try and empathize in ways that are uncomfortable. But, you know, you see those photos all the time, you know, and they look like Renaissance paintings of, you know, the riot divider, and on one side it's all people dressed in red with cowboy hats and Trump signs screaming, and on the other side it's people with Biden signs and they're screaming, and it's just like, is anything getting through to anyone? Like, what are you really achieving here?
Yeah.
And it's not to say that maybe a calm conversation would achieve anything, but it probably has a better chance of achieving something.
Well,
some moment of like, yeah, okay, I get it. Your life's been decimated. You got sold a faulty bill of goods with this dumb American dream, and now you're 60 and nothing worked out and you're fucking angry. I'm not saying that who you're blaming is correct, but I can maybe empathize with the rage or the feeling of
how you got
being
here.
Abandoned.
Yes.
And maybe if I can empathize with the feeling of how you got here, we can start to have a conversation that isn't just me condemning you and basically saying you need to fuck off and die, which is kind of a lot of the rhetoric coming from both sides.
Yes.
You know, you are the Antichrist and you need to fuck off and die.
Yes.
And if you get any power, we're all going to be in fucking concentration camps.
It's funny,
terrible.
There was an argument over the weekend which you were seeing some right-wing pundits say, oh, look what happens when we lose. There's no riots. Mm. When you lose, there's riots. And it's like, yeah, but when that side loses, they lose more rights. And when you lose, you go home to your house and maybe pay a little bit more tax.
Yeah.
So it's a bad argument.
Yeah. I mean, and thank God. I mean, it was almost like they were trying to incite that. Because I think that was the big fear during the election, right? That there was going to be major violence.
I still have that fear.
Yeah. By no means. We're recording this, what, on...
Like
the 10th of November. This could still all go very, very pear-shaped. I mean, Trump this morning fired his Secretary of Defense. What the fuck does that mean?
Yes.
You know, what the fuck is he trying to pull?
You've only got 2 months.
Mm.
You have something.
Yeah, you got something up your sleeve. I have my theories on what he's going to do, but anyway, we maybe can talk about that later. But yeah, I you know, thank God there was no violence.
Yes.
Up until now.
But the decency that's inherent in this film, and I think that's what it is based on. It's about decent people trying to be decent in indecent times.
Yep.
We'll get more into that a little bit later on. This was actually the question I was going to throw this to you. I think this might technically be Nolan's best movie.
Really?
Yes. Interstellar's my favorite.
Yeah, right.
And
you, what you mean, like on a filmmaking,
just as a canvas, rewatching it and like watching it because we're watching things with different eyes and trying to find new things to talk about movies that have been out for a while.
Yeah,
just watching it as a piece of art.
Yeah,
I think it. Like, I love Tenet, and we will get to Tenet.
Yep.
But I also view Tenet as David Bowie released a 78-minute album in the 90s called Outside, which I love more than anything and I think is a masterpiece. But if people say to me, what's with all these dumbass characters and what's with this narrative that doesn't make sense and what's with these weird noises, I don't like that, I would go, yeah. That's fair enough. And that's how I feel about Tenet.
Yeah, this was made for the real fans. And, you know, you're either on board or you're not.
And I get it.
Yeah.
I completely get it. Yeah. I've discovered something that I'm very excited to share with you that might help unlock Tenet as well.
All right.
But I will save that for later.
All right.
A little bit of forward selling back from my radio days, kids. But watching this film, I think this is... I feel like going back and reading what people loved about it and some of the criticism... I think people are missing a lot of stuff because it's minimalist and bombastic at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think it's full of character.
Yeah, it is.
The character beats just come at different places.
Yeah.
I don't think it's sentimental.
No.
Because sentimental is that scene you just said. They get into land and Tommy goes up to Harry Styles and says, "You killed our French friend and he saved us." He was there for us. He saved us. And you did this.
Yeah.
You got to look at yourself. You're I don't know what my accent is. But
yeah. It kind of went from Cockney to Scottish, but that's all
right. But do you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, when that guy comes up and yells at the Scottish pilot, you know, Mark Rylance comes in and says, "You don't understand what I saw.
I
saw him up there. He went down. He nearly died."
That's
sentimental. Right. But this is actually... old school, stiff upper lip, just decent and...
non-reactionary.
Yeah, and I think everything from the music to the use of sound to the action to the way it looks, I think it's a masterpiece and I think it's its best film.
I was thinking this last night, like I think it's an expressionistic masterpiece in like that it's almost like the reverse side of a Terrence Malick film, where it's an experiential film.
Yes.
It's not necessarily... And this is only the third time I've seen it, and it's been a few years. And this is only the first time that I actually was able to track all the characters and not just be lost in the complete fucking panic attack of what was happening.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you remember the first time we saw it? We were sitting down the front.
Yeah.
And I remember getting pins and needles in my arms because I was pushing my elbows back into the seat so hard. And
totally.
I actually thought for a moment I was going to have a heart attack and I was at peace with that. I thought, like, if I can just get to the end of the movie and die, then...
this is my Dunkirk.
This is a good way to go.
But the first time it's such a full frontal assault. And, you know, a lot of those young English boys look very similar. So it's easy to... Similar with...
Yes.
A lot of war movies are like that. Black Hawk Down was like that. The Thin Red Line is like that. Wait, who's that guy again? Fuck.
And it's part of the point.
Part of the point. The confusion of it all. But this time I was able to fully track where each one of them start and where each one of them end. And also the time skips were much more... made a lot more sense to me this time. But I really had that feeling halfway through. I was like, oh, this reminds me of... more of Terrence Malick than any other director, because it is about how this thing makes you feel, less about where we're going and more just like you are in a situation and you know, you've got to deal with this.
Yeah.
And you've got to deal with whatever it's bringing up in you, which is panic and horrendous anxiety.
Yes, right? And I think because some people aren't into war movies or people like... You know, it's in one of my facts later, so I'll try to remember not to repeat it, but, you know, Nolan didn't see it as a war movie. He saw it as a suspense film.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, if you were going to put this on as a double with another movie, you wouldn't put it on with another war movie. You'd probably put it on with Gravity.
Totally. Totally.
And then all my teeth would shatter from the way I'd just been clenching them for so long in the cinema. But I think everything about it is just an amazing work of art, and without, and it doesn't outstay its welcome.
No, it couldn't. It couldn't go for much longer than it does. Honestly, like, and that's not, you know, that's no criticism of the film. It's just
It's where it's at. Did you know the Dunkirk story that well before you saw the movie?
No, I didn't know it at all.
I vaguely, like, I knew the broad strokes of a lot of soldiers were saved, and it was a turning point in the war.
Yeah.
But that's all I knew.
I know. I knew it was a big part of, like, English folklore and that kind of stuff, but no, not the specifics.
Yeah. And so you were talking about following the film. It's dissected into three storylines: the week on the beach for the soldiers, the day the boats took to sail to Dunkirk, and the hour the planes could remain in the air. So going by what you were saying from your first two viewings, you found that difficult to...
First time I didn't realize what the fuck was going on. Like, I really didn't. I was a dumb movie watcher, and I didn't pay attention to 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour. And
even though it comes up,
even
literally.
Though it's right there, right in front of your face. But again, it was just that thing of, like, and you know, I actually like that, you know, when I was younger, I used to go into movies and really deconstruct it, and you know, especially after going to TV school, you know. You really get into the kind of form of how things are made. Whereas in the last few years, it really is just about just sit there and let it go over you. Let it wash over you. Yes. And if you understand it, fine. If you don't, that's okay. You'll probably end up watching this again, which is how I felt about Tenet. Yes. It was, you know, half an hour in, I was like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. And I'm beyond the point of trying to figure it out. Let's just have it.
Yes.
So the editing in Dunkirk is so... it seems that each shot really does seamlessly flow into the next.
Yes.
It was only when, I think, maybe three quarters into the movie, where you start seeing repeated moments where I was like, oh, wait a second, this is, he's doing weird shit with time. And then I think I resented it because I didn't know. I was like, what the fuck? Are you just trying to be tricksy? And then this time I was like, no. And then especially this time, being fully cognizant of that juncture point where all three timelines smack into themselves. And it's perfect. It's perfect.
So good. Yeah. Once again, we are going over some ground that we might cover a bit later. So pull me up if I forget. But the scene that I really love, which is... actually, you know what? I'll save it. But 'cause there's a specific question I want to ask you. By the way, it's Lee Smith... who is the Australian editor who edited movie, yeah. And he did a magnificent job. Mm. Was there a storyline that appealed the most?
Oh, the beach stuff, of course.
Right.
I think that's the most relatable in terms of just kind of raw, you know, reactionary human, you know. I mean, I can imagine myself cowering on a beach, shitting my pants. I don't know if I can imagine myself in a Spitfire going...
Right. Right. I love the matter-of-fact dialogue. Like, there's that point where... It is funny. It is hard to remember the character's names. Collins is flying and he's like, I've got this, you know, he's on me. And you just hear Tom Hardy just really cool, calm, collected. I'm on him.
Yeah.
Comes in behind. Like, to me, the heroism in this movie is how matter-of-fact it is.
Totally.
It's not like, don't worry, man, I got you. I got him.
Yeah. Absolutely. That, I think that's the thing the American war movies never get. It's like the guys that are doing those jobs are of a different species. They don't feel emotion. I mean, I can't imagine you're in some little fucking tin can that has an hour's worth of fuel in it. You know, I mean, I don't know that you can be succumbing to any kinds of extreme feelings, be it terror or, rah, rah, rah. I think you are just focused on the task expecting to get shot out of the fucking sky at any moment.
Well, he's so matter of fact when his fuel gauge has been cracked. Where are you up to? Yeah. Okay.
Are you sure it's just your fuel? Yeah, sure, it's just a fuel gauge.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
For a bombastic movie, I think I like the plane stuff because it is thrilling, and it also, it just looks beautiful.
Yeah, there were many times where I was out loud gasping, like, whoa.
Oh, so beautiful.
Just as a quick side note, because, you know,
that's what we should have called our podcast, Side Note. We're very good at it. TM, trademarked. Don't take it, whoever's listening. I'm on to you.
Quick Dunkirk side note. Have you ever heard the audio of the Apollo 11 astronauts when they detach from the they're in the landing vessel.
Yes.
And they're spaced on the moon that they're supposed to land in, turns out to be a crater.
Yes.
And they've got no fuel left. They're out of time. And it really, like, you're watching the footage going, they're going to, knowing full well that they don't.
Yes.
Your brain can't compute, like, there's way too much distance.
Yes.
And not enough fuel. And you can hear ground control being like, we're very concerned, Neil, you're running out of fuel. And he never once sounds like he's a man who's about to crash into the moon and die. Like, he's completely zen the whole time. And how could you not be? Like, you would have to be that person to pull it off.
That's funny, isn't it? So that's where I think the Ryan Gosling movie gets short shrift, because it's literally depicting what kind of person can pull this off.
Totally.
And it's funny. I think Apollo 13 is a great movie, but there is a scene that they made up where they all freak the fuck out just to...
No.
Give it something. And it's just a small scene where they just, you know, but they did that for movie making reasons. Yeah, yeah. But realistically, they were like, oh, well, we've got some gum here and we've got a pen lid and we've got some gaffer. Let's get home.
Yeah, totally. But how else could you? Like, if you were a normal, whatever, quote unquote normal person, but, you know, you're like more driven by your reptile brain than your ape brain, you would just, like, you're on the dark side of the moon.
I'm sitting here with both legs jigging and everything's fine.
Like, in the Ryan Gosling movie, because, I mean, I thought that was really pumped up. I didn't think that was real. I was like, oh, they've really added this up to... And then when you look at the real footage, it's like, no, they're not exaggerating at all. He literally landed on the surface of the moon with 2 seconds left of fuel. It's unfucking believable.
Yes.
And you hear the real audio and he's cool as a cucumber.
In a spaceship that's fueled by a Nokia.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's amazing.
For a bombastic movie, there are quite avant-garde scenes, such as the propaganda pamphlets being dropped on the soldiers or the man who walks out to sea.
Or whenever the camera goes on its side and the water goes vertical, beautiful.
I was about to say, were there any particular scenes that stood out to you?
Those ones.
They're amazing, aren't they?
The real brain fizzers where you're like, I mean, I haven't even really rewatched them. And my instinct just goes, oh, you've just turned the camera on its side. But when I was seeing it, it was so surreal that my brain was like fritzing. Like, what the fuck? What is that?
Yes.
When they're all pressed against one wall and the water's moving towards them. I can't even describe it. Unbelievable.
Here's a slightly lighter question for you. The first time we see Tommy, who's played by Finn Whitehead, who I think is... They were looking for unknowns, and I think that kid...
He's great.
...does a remarkable job.
Yeah.
But the first time you see him, he's literally attempting to take a shit. This movie could be a story about a kid who just wants to take a shit, and the Germans won't let him. So
I think with all the circumstances he finds himself in, it would be no trouble taking a shit when he's on that boat. There's a whole lot of instances where it would just happen automatically.
Maybe that scene at the end with Harry Styles isn't him feeling shame. He's looking at Tommy going, you've taken a shit, haven't you? That's not oil on you at all. I'm curious, why do you think Nolan started at that point?
I think it's to remind you that this isn't really a war movie. This is a movie about just basic human survival.
Yes.
And what's a more basic, animal trait than shitting?
Yeah.
Eating, shitting, and fucking. That's really all we are.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I think it's a really underrated throwaway moment that just reminds you that these are real people doing real things. Because you never, like, I can't even think off the top of my head movies where someone says, I'm just going to go to the toilet.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially war movies. Again, it's because, you know, in a typical American rah-rah war movie, and a character expressing the vulnerability of needing to shit, because when are you more vulnerable than when you're going to the toilet? Like,
right.
You can't do anything. Would, you know, belie the kind of character that they're trying to put forward, this fucking macho man. I think opening with a guy needing to take his shit, you know, is... And then he never does.
No.
So in the back of your head, you're always like, oh, you poor bastard.
Well, then he gets down to the beach and he sees the French guy getting the shoes and it's like, he can't take a shit. This guy's watching.
Yeah. It's in the docking station. It's got to go back up.
This is a disaster. John Travolta in Pulp Fiction. And guess what? Vulnerable.
Yeah,
get
yeah,
shot.
Very vulnerable. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Totally. But you see it, like, you know, like you see it when you go into a men's toilet. If there's a guy at the urinal, when you walk in, there's a slight imperceptible... I really believe it's a primal thing.
Yes.
Of like, I can't defend myself if this guy decides to kick off.
Yes.
There's no logic in it. It's purely caveman shit. But it really is. Like, I think it's...
If you ended up in a fight while you were taking a piss, what would, like, I feel like my first move would be to piss on them.
Yeah, of course. You just whip around them.
Yes. And then while they were dealing with that, I'd go completely...
Dive between their legs, slide, wet and slip and slide on the piss through their legs.
Nah, I'd fight like a winner. I choose to believe. Nah, I'd probably burst into tears. Who am I kidding? Oh, no, I've pissed on you. This is awful. Why'd you start the fight now? Didn't even have time to stretch. Also, but the other thing is, like, so, you know, all jokes aside, he's just trying to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
And then it's so funny, isn't it? You have the merest of seconds where you see one of the kids trying to take a cigarette.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, well, we must be following this battalion. And then, like, a minute later, just Tommy.
Yeah.
It's an audacious opening because as you're sort of sitting there and thinking, okay, I'll get my head around these characters. And then you go, oh, like 95% of them are already gone.
Yeah.
So it raises the stakes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it reminds you of the truth of war that, like, the guy that survives is not the guy who's, you know, got the biggest abs who runs screaming into the fray. It's completely random. It's, you know, I remember, you know, when I kind of understood what my grandpa had been through in the war. And, you know, when I got him to tell me the whole story, it's basically just a series of lucky misses, almost, if I turned left instead of right, I'd be dead. You wouldn't exist. Like, just on and on and on, just one after the other, where you realize it's just, you know, you're kind of, you know, you could think that you're doing the right thing, but you're literally running into gunfire. Like, yes. it's completely random. And I think that's what's so terrifying about war.
Tommy gets away from the Germans and then Neely gets taken out by the Allies.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then those French soldiers, like, just kind of give him a look as if to say, get over here. Like, there's no, hey, you're all right?
Yeah.
We've got a job and you're getting in the way.
Get
over and get out.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the criticism that that some people level at the film that it lacks characterization, but as I said, I think it's full of it, and you just have to be paying attention.
Right.
I have three moments that stand out to me, and I was wondering, do you want to tell me if there's any that stand out for you, and I'll see if I've got them, or do you want me to just throw them your way?
Well, the one you mentioned earlier really struck me last night. The one where Harry Styles has that moment of, you know, oh, maybe I'm not a great guy. You tell me, what are yours?
So you're following Tommy for the whole movie and you're on his side because he's in danger and you see him go through all sorts of, as you said, near misses, like that bomb that comes.
Oh, God.
And it's like blows that soldier up. By the way, Nolan really killed that actor to get the shot in the camera. But then, you know, they find that poor guy who's on a stretcher.
Yeah.
They race him to a boat.
Yeah.
That boat gets sunk. That guy's dead.
Yeah.
Like, he was probably better on the beach.
Yeah.
So then...
Might be a quicker death in the boat.
Maybe. But, but then they end up in the boat that gets sunk.
Torpedo.
And not all of those people get out.
Yeah.
And then they end up... Like, there's so many near misses. So, of course, you're on his side. But characterization-wise, it's when they're all together and they're going to throw the French kid out and he just says, you know, I can't do it. He stood by us. He's on our side. And he'll say, I'll live with it. And he doesn't at any point not say he doesn't want to go home when they suggest you're out next. And he's like, what? Like, no, I have to go.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that he ever forgets that his desire is to get out of there, but that he stands up for that kid. Because he knows it's the right thing to do. Yeah. And it's like, okay, I know I'm 2/3 of the way through this film, but you've justified me being on this kid's side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it really, I think that from all the stories I've heard about war from people who have actually participated in it, there does seem to be a moment where, you know, you have to choose between survival at all costs or preserving your soul. and what you can and can't live with if you do decide to do something just heinous.
Yes.
Just to survive. There was a... growing up, there was a guy tangential to our family. And I knew that everyone in our family hated him. Just hated, which is very unusual for my family. They're very compassionate, forgiving people. And then at a funeral one time, this gentleman grabbed me and he dragged me over to a series of graves and he's pointing at them going, that's my wife and that's my daughter and that's my... Like, just out of his mind. And my grandpa came up to me and like tore me away and go, don't talk to him. And it turned out he was a capo in the concentration camps. Right. And for anyone that doesn't know, a capo is, that's a Jewish person who basically was recruited by the Gestapo to basically push their fellow Jews into ovens and drag out the dead bodies. And evidently, and of course, my family fucking hated him because he was
yes.
the ultimate traitor. And I remember looking at the guy and having like a compassion for him in the sense of like, were you evil or did you just do this thing because you're weak and you were terrified and you wanted to survive? And now you're here, you are at the end of your life. And I don't believe the universe cursed him and killed his daughters and his wife or anything. But here you are, like you're all alone, you're an old man, your whole family died way before you ever did. And how can you not look at your life as this cursed thing? And was it really worth it to do all these just terrible, terrible things? Because I think we'd all like to think that if we were in that position, you know, hey, I'll kill you or you can be the guy that puts kids in ovens, that you'd say, well, just fucking kill me. There's no way I can do that.
Yes.
But, you know... I hope I know about myself.
Yes.
But then you look at these genocides and wars and all these things and they are fully enabled by the enablers, you know. If everyone said, no, I'm not doing that, then it would never happen. I think that raises really interesting questions about, you know, what you are willing to do to survive. And that moment where he says, I think he literally says, if I do it, I won't be able to live with myself.
Yes.
And he recognizes that in the moment, even in the face of death. And you would hope that you are that guy.
Yeah. And it's a great moment of, once again, the character.
Yeah.
And it justifies, well, I feel good about being on this kid's side.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Gibson's death is tragic as well. It's funny because... Styles goes back to let him know and then he just gets caught and gets taken under and you go, oh, and that's never mentioned. And that's part of the tragedy of it all. Those people who would have died that nobody mourns or his family would never know what happened to him.
Yeah, so of course, it's just disappeared.
So that's one of my favourite moments of character. Mm. The next is Mark Rylance as Mr. Dawson, who shows real stoicism all the way through. Like about the only time you ever really hear his voice go up is right at the start when he says, "To war, George." Like, that's about the only time you hear any loop. But then when the plane crashes and he's trying to get to him and his son Peter says, oh, well, he's probably dead. And he snaps. Like, he really snaps. Yeah. And it's really jarring because you go, oh, my God, where did that come from? And then when...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Scottish pilot is on the plane and you learn, oh, his eldest brother was a pilot who went down the first weeks of the war. Yeah. And this is what he's doing. He's trying to make up for everyone else's children that he couldn't for his.
Yeah. Yeah. He's trying to save his son.
Like, what a great moment of like, if you don't pick up on that, I feel like you're not watching the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or first time round, you're just by the whole thing.
Yeah, I get that. But
that is a very clear character moment.
Yeah, you just sometimes, I think we're so conditioned, and I know we can make fun of Nolan with his non-linear storytelling and everything, but we're so conditioned to buy the book linear storytelling that we forget that sometimes important beats can come later.
Yes.
And you just apply them. You just that's why he yelled and that's why he's doing this.
Totally.
That's why he's in this boat right at the start of the movie. Yeah,
why he doesn't let the Navy requisition his boat. It has to be him.
It has to be him because he couldn't save his son.
Yeah, that's great.
That's
great.
Mark Rylance, I wish we were friends.
Can I suggest the third one? I think I know what it is.
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to throw this out there. Top three moments in any Nolan movie for me.
Oh, okay. That's a more complicated one. Let me get to that in a second. The Dunkirk moment, character beat, when Cillian Murphy asks if the boy is okay.
That is so...
And he is given his... Oh. You know, there's grace. And again, that goes back to that kind of like... That thing that we all need right now, a little bit of fucking understanding. Like, it's not that... I can't remember the character's name, the son of Mark Rylance.
Yeah, Peter.
Who gives him that forgiveness. It's, again, it's the similar with Tommy and Harry Styles. It's not absolution. It is understanding. It is, this guy was out of his fucking mind, and I understand why he's out of his mind. Doesn't mean... that I'm not grieving for this dead boy and all this other stuff, but he didn't mean to do it, and it wasn't a malicious act. It was an act born of fear and trauma.
I actually had that later on to really dig into. It's the only reason it's not in my top three is because A, it would have been a top four, but it is. I want to dig into that a bit later, but let's dig into it now. That moment, because he's already told him off before. No, he's not.
Yeah.
But then at that moment. And that scene, like, the storyline of George, I'll be useful, sir, and he's kind of not.
No, not at all.
And then he dies by accident, and then when you realise, it's, once again, in a lesser movie, that is played for tears.
Mm.
But it's just Styles looking up and going, he's dead, mate.
He's dead, mate.
So, well, be bloody careful. And then they just push him to one side, and it's so tragic. And when Cillian Murphy... asks if he's okay. You're right. The moment of grace that young boy gives that character makes me teary even thinking about it. But then you go to the dad, and there's a beat, and he looks at him and he nods.
Yeah.
And then that moment, that little boy becomes a man.
Yes, it's such a fucking great.
And of course, you know, he goes and gets the story in the paper because he wanted to be in the paper. That scene is...
I think that's the best scene of the whole movie. Because there's a moment, because it's a beautiful piece of acting as well, where you see that there's something that goes over his eyes where he wants to say, no, fuck you, you killed him.
Yes.
But he makes the choice.
He makes the choice.
You know what, this guy... And then the terrible irony at the end is he sees the body being taken out of the boat anyway, but...
Oh, and then disappears. Yeah. Like, that's such a haunting...
Yeah.
That was going to be one of my... That's why I was going to have it later, because one of my questions is, like, what happens to that guy? Because he doesn't even get a name. He's just shivering officer. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier about you don't know what you would be like, because we see him as the shivering officer, but then we see that scene earlier before he gets to that point, and he is very practical, and he is a leader of men, and he is calm, and he gives good advice, and then whatever happened in the meantime has ruined him. And I'm curious, this is the question I wanted to ask you, does he see the body and register, or does he... dissipate into the night because there's just a part of him that can't even acknowledge that as the reality?
Both and all things.
Yes.
You know, I think the power of a lot of these characters in this movie are that they are representational, and, you know, they kind of are symbols of different mindsets in war and different ways of behaving and different ways of reacting. And I think... Yes, there's character arcs within that, of course, but I think what each character represents as a symbol is so much more powerful than their individual trajectory as that character.
And that's why you see him disappear.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was saying before about it being, you know, for me, it's a very expressionistic film. similar to Terrence Malick in that, this is about bringing up feelings and emotions in the viewer and what would I do in that situation. And like the best of Nolan films, it's kind of like it can be different every time. You can relate to different things each time you watch it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, such a... And beautifully acted on everyone's... Yeah. Like, Cillian Murphy, like, gee whiz. Yeah. Like, such a hard character to portray because in many ways you're not on his side. Mm. But because it's a hard character to completely empathize with, but you do.
Oh, and you get it?
Yeah.
That moment where he stands up and he's like, wait, where are we going?
Oh.
Like, back to the war. Yeah. What?
Even the way he yells is not, like... Once again, it could have been, you should be at home, but it's not. It's like, it's really kind of impotent.
Yeah.
This impotent rage.
He's broken. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, the fact that you see him, the first time you see him, in that crouched position on top, like, he is a broken man, and he's basically waiting to die. He doesn't know that boat's yacht coming. Is about to come. He basically thinks he's going to sit on this boat until it sinks, and then he'll drown.
Yeah.
As far as he's concerned, he's already dead.
He doesn't even really acknowledge them when they first turn up. And there's a really interesting moment when George says, is he a coward, sir? And I was like, no, he's shell-shocked. Yeah, he may never come back.
Uh-huh.
So my favourite scene is... And just Tom Hardy in the plane.
Mm.
All you can see is his eyes.
Mm.
He's running out of fuel. Mm. He sees the bomber. He sees the boat. Mm. He sees the soldiers in the water. And you see him do the math. And he makes the decision to stay, knowing full well he's probably never going to get back to England.
Yeah.
And then the way the plane veers and the music swells, and it is fucking perfection.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Perfection.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is, once again, the decent thing to do because, like, even at the start, it's like, hey, make sure you still have enough fuel to get home. Yeah. And he knows.
Yeah.
This is it for him, but he has to do this. Or everyone's in trouble.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that being the point where the three timelines converge. So it really does kind of hammer that moment home.
It is like it's funny feeling, having watched it a lot, but not for a while.
Yeah.
And just sitting here by myself and like feeling my chest constricting like, I knew this was coming up and I'm still feeling this great ride. Let's avoid... that's funny. I was just about to go straight into all the Cillian Murphy stuff. We don't need to do that. How'd you feel about Harry Styles in the movie?
This time, I really didn't like him, but that was not his being Harry Styles or anything. I think the character in itself is not the guy that I'd want next to me in a situation like that. He's a prick.
Definitely.
He's a fucking twat.
But it's funny. So I find his character, I think Styles does a really good job. Yeah. I have to be honest, when I heard that Harry Styles was in it, my first reaction was, ugh. And then I was like, hang on, why did I have that reaction? And then it was like, oh, he's in a band called One Direction. And I was like, I don't even know who they are.
Exactly.
They're a boy band. Ugh. Yeah. And then I was like, I've never listened to One Direction. And then I saw him in this and I thought, oh, he's really good.
Don't be so judgmental, old man.
Yeah.
I was the same.
And then I bought his album. And I listened to it three times and I thought, this is not for me. But I thought it was a good album. But I gave it a go. And that's why... I try to be my best. I gave it a go.
Yep.
But anyway, I think his character is kind of fascinating because in some ways he's the most well-rounded character in the movie because the first time you see him, he's about to get crushed by that boat.
Yeah.
He gets pulled to safety and then he sees the two lads that save him dip themselves in the water and he smiles because he goes, I see what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then, but as the movie wears on, like when they go down and he's just eating and that, it's like, hey, why'd you... friends stay up there, and the look on his face when he says, oh, a quick getaway, and he has that moment. And I feel like that little moment when Tommy just sort of says, very matter of fact, a quick getaway, it was the first time he's like, oh, this boat might go down as well, which it does.
Mm.
And then to end up on the boat that's being filled full of holes and the way he turns and like he's already, before that moment even happens, he's all frustrated and he's starting to lose his mind.
Yep.
Then the moment when he's covered in oil and you see the despair in his eyes and his inability to, like, he can't even look at the people at the window because he's sure that he's kind of a fascinating character because you see a real just bits journey of how he deteriorates and you definitely, like, I'm like you would not want him alongside you because he's projecting a lot of internal...
And that like trying to control a situation that is spun really out of control and not controlling it in that you know, you want a Tom Hardy, you want a Mike Rylance, you want a Neil Armstrong, you want someone who's not getting emotional, not getting flustered and going, okay, we're in a bit of a bind.
Yeah.
Let's figure out how to get out of this, not pointing guns at people and demanding that they get out of the boat, which is not going to make a fucking difference at this point anyway.
Yeah, and it still shows the xenophobia is present. You know, he calls him a stinking frog and it's like, mate, that guy literally saved your life.
Yeah, he saved your life. Yeah. Two times.
Yeah. Kenneth Branagh is great.
Yep.
He's like grim determination. He has wry humor. Is there a scene with Branagh that stands out for you? I feel like there's all these really lovely little moments that I enjoy. There's the moment when talking about the tides and it comes every day. Well, it's a good thing you're Army and I'm Navy. And the way he delivers it is just, there's just this slight little hint of humor.
Yeah,
I love when the boats are coming over and he's asking where they're from, and there's just that moment where, and thank you.
Yeah.
And at the end when the boy is asleep, I know we're officers. Yeah. I think he's pitch perfect.
Yeah. And the way he delivers the word home.
Oh yeah, it's very relaxing. Once again, you know, I guess I feel like, taken out of context, that is a moment that you could say is sentimental, but you earn it.
Yeah, he's yearning. He's in a pretty fucked up situation.
Yeah, but you also earn that moment because I've been having a heart attack for an hour, and it's not even like there's still shit to do.
Yeah, I like the moment. It's very tiny, but where he salutes in silhouette, where he's standing on the pier as they pull away, and it's almost like that idea that the best idea that people do have of the military encompassed in one image, just this proud, staunch, this compassion, it's all things. And it's just done in a, you know, in that very confident salute that he gives. And you can't even see the expression in his face. But to me, that's like, again, go back to that expressionist thing. It's like, oh, this is, you know, when we want to have a good dream about what the military can be, that's what it is. Not Harry Styles screaming, "You stinking frog!"
Yes. The James Darcy's underrated in this as well as the army guy who is kind of his foil in many ways. Yeah. You know, even when he goes to repeat his line back, you can almost, well, that's not going to help us. You know, all of that is... Yeah. But the look he gives Branagh as he's getting down and realises what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Like, it is... Of course, you know, throughout history, it is dangerous to romanticize that a time before was better in many ways, but that particular thread of humanity and that stoicism and that decency does feel very old-fashioned and does feel lost.
Absolutely.
So
at the very least, that we're not going to fucking stomp on someone's face when they're down,
right
which is very much the
By the way, just getting slightly off topic, you know, one thing that has been making me laugh a lot and it keeps turning up in my timeline on my social media are the old people who are Trump supporters who are dancing to Rage Against the Machine, doing the whole, "We won't do what you told us." And I'm like... Oh,
really?
Yeah. And Bubs. I think who's the guitarist? Tommy Ribello? Romello? I can't think of his name off the top of my head.
Tom Morello.
He wrote on Twitter, "We didn't quite have this in mind when we created this song." Anyway.
Really, they're doing... Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and they're just going back and forth and there's...
Fuck you, you won't do it. Like, that's sad when a 15-year-old does it, let alone a person in their 60s. Right. Come on.
That's so funny. Dressed in your Trump gear.
Oh, gosh.
We've already talked about Peter and George. So, I've talked a little bit about George being a tragic character, but he's remembered in the papers as having an heroic death. Is this... What do you make of this scene? Is this a small example of the stories we tell ourselves to maintain spirit?
Of them putting him in the paper?
Yeah. Or is there something... I'm not sure. I don't necessarily believe this, but I'm curious to know. Is there something a little bit dangerous in changing a narrative like that to tell a more positive story? I think it's fine.
I think it's them... I think for them, it's they probably carry a lot of guilt that they allowed a child to come along, you know...
With them.
And, you know, it's one thing to go, oh, we're going to war. But that kid can't fucking conceive of that. That's why armies are full of teenagers right out of high school, because they think it's, they can't possibly conceive.
Well, the right thing for them to do would be to turn, to pull right back up and get him off. But then the officers get his boat, and he is fueled by making up for what he couldn't do.
Absolutely. And, you know, they could have chucked a life vest on him and thrown him overboard. But, you know, whatever. They decide to take him. So, and which, you know, directly leads to his death. The only death on that boat. So I think that they have to do that. It's probably for him. It's probably more for themselves, though.
Yeah.
Commemorate it so it's not a complete loss.
Only a few more questions for you. Do you think this movie did incredibly well? It did well in the States, but do you think it would have done even better if it was a story about Americans?
Yeah, of course.
Or if there'd been some crowd-pleasing moments?
Yeah, of course.
Added, you know, like maybe Tommy pulls out of his wallet a picture of his sweetheart that he left behind.
Yeah. And she's waiting at the train station.
There she is. Yeah, for some reason, she's on the boat. Turns out Peter is P-E-T-A. The scene with the small boats, which we just talked about, coming up over the shore, is a genuinely moving moment. Yeah. Were there any other scenes that kind of took you by surprise emotionally? One of the scenes that is weirdly emotional for me is when they're taking the guy on the stretcher and they come across the plank. And
that's beautiful.
Yes, and the way the guy just sort of says, "Go on, mate," like, and then have a run at it.
Have
that little cheer.
Yeah,
which is that feels emotionally correct.
Yes. I watched it with my buddy last night, and we both were very heartily laughing. Not at that scene, but with that scene of like, oh, that feels very real. That in this incredibly tense moment, this guy pulls off a hat trick like that. Of course, everyone's like, if for no other reason than just the need to have a couple of seconds of levity.
Yeah, you've been stuck there for days, and you are stressed. Yeah, you know, and that is every victory, no matter how minor, is still a victory.
Yeah. I think there's that beautiful sense of old world decency as well, that they're literally lining up to get on a boat so that they don't die, and they are not elbowing each other in the face. They're not being savage. And then you contrast that with fucking footage of like Black Friday sales where people are murdering each other so they can get $10 off an Xbox. And it's just like, what is wrong with us?
Yes.
What's become of us?
I watched Brave New World, which unfortunately got cancelled after one season. And it wasn't perfect, but it had really good ideas. I wish it had gotten a second season, because I think it would have found its voice a little bit better. But there is a really funny satirical bit where they go to the Savage Lands, and it's America, and they watch these people reenact the Black Friday stuff, and it's really funny. It's a really funny scene. Anyway,
you see that stuff and it's just like, oh, we're really fucked as a species.
Yes,
it's bad.
I also really, really love the scene where the poor guy is Collins is can't get out of his plane.
Yeah.
And you are like, you know the boat's coming for him, but you don't know. Like this movie, you don't know if they're going to get to him in time.
Totally.
And when they pull him out, and as he's being held up, he's just like,
"Hello,
good afternoon." Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Like, the most unexpected save of all time. Like, no,
but he's composed himself immediately, and I love, like, that is such a small moment. But even, I feel like that's a really, like, I could have watched a whole movie about that character.
Yeah, he's
like,
great.
Even when he's in the boat and he's like, come on, Favia. He's really, even the way they get excited at seeing the planes come over, and there's this real, like, we are very privileged to live in a world where the things that we can get excited about are pop culture and sporting events.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, watching those pilots and knowing those people were fighting the good fight.
Fuck yeah.
Priorities. Yeah. Nolan said he abandoned the conventional ideas of backstory and dialogue to explain why we should have sympathy for a character. And do you think this is why a movie like The Shape of Water won Best Picture over this, which is like, Jesus shit. To anyone listening who likes that movie, you know this is a podcast where I don't like to shit on things because everyone has their POV, but fuck me.
I hate that movie
so much. I hate that movie too.
I hate it. Just as a side note, again, I don't like Guillermo del Toro. I find him to be the emperor with no clothes. And I think I was talking about this with our friend Alexi from Total Reboot a while ago. And he's the same. He's like, I don't like Guillermo del Toro. And we're like, but why? Because on paper, he's everything that I love. I love monsters. And I love crazy art design and cogs and all that stuff. But there's just something about when he puts a movie together, it does not work for me. And when Shape of Water became this thing that everyone was like losing their minds over, I was like, I don't.
Like,
it
kills me as a lover of genre.
Yeah.
That's the genre movie we all decided.
Yeah.
Like, I will give you this. I love the color palette.
Yeah, sure. And I love the monster makeup. It looks great.
But I can't, like, no. Like, what the fuck? Like, this is a fucking masterpiece.
Yeah, I know.
That is important. That tells an important story. Yeah, yeah. And You don't even nominate Interstellar and you give it to the fish fucking movie?
No, unbelievable.
Fuck me.
With this weird mixed metaphor.
Hang on, I better write down, I've got to put explicit language in this podcast. But it just drives me insane.
Yeah, but the Oscars.
And you know what? Anyone who is listening, once again, I don't want to rain on your parade. If you really enjoy this movie,
sure,
please write to me on the Big Squid Facebook page and explain what you love about it. We will not take the piss out of you, but I desperately need to know what you see in it, because all I see is something that makes me really sad about movies.
Yeah. I think for people like us, it also has that sting because it is stuff that we like in other mediums.
Yes.
And I always think the stuff that you love in another medium when it's depicted in film or whatever that doesn't quite get there for you, it's extra upsetting because it's like, oh, all these ingredients
are there.
Ingredients I like, but you've made it into a fucking souffle that tastes like shit.
By the way, I just need to point out how this getting angry about The Shape of Water doubles down on my last comment about we live in a world where we can be angry about The Shape of Water.
I know. Also, the Oscars, I mean, come on.
But I was sitting, like, who gives a fuck about awards,
You go to Wikipedia and look at Oscar winners of, you know, throughout history.
Yes.
And then you look at what they're up against, and it's always the things they're up against that are the movies that we remember decades later. Like, it's never,
you know. I just remember watching it, and the further it went, because you know what I'm like as a moviegoer. Mm. I go in optimistic, and I try to enjoy everything, and I stick with the movie right to the end. In the off chance, I say, well, that was shit, but the ending kind of took me by surprise. Like, I'd rather have some feeling of...
You were saying positive things about Justice League. That's how positive you are going into cinemas.
Look, we may have been pretty high. I have this... You know what? I cannot wait for this.
Dude, I am... there's nothing I'm looking forward to more than the four-hour Snyder cut of Justice League. I can't fucking wait. Not because I like Justice League. I love Ayn Randian, nightmarish Zack Snyder movies. I think they're so funny.
Let's do this. Dude. Like, my one criticism is that it's not 24 episodes.
That's so good. It's so funny.
So the actors are all age-appropriate.
Yes.
And British. And as I said, you know, when I heard about Harry Styles, I had a very old man reaction to it. And then I watched it and I went, oh, I was wrong about that. So as a little fun question for you, who's the worst actor you can think of that could have been cast in this movie?
Oh, Jesus.
Is there someone that you just go, like...
There's multiple options because, you know, if you went with anyone too big a personality, because I think it works that everyone's kind of like a little bit vanilla. So if you put like a Nicolas Cage in a movie like this, maybe not the best fit.
What about Tom Cruise in Kenneth Branagh's role?
Yeah, no.
It's okay. We can see home from it. No. Dial it back.
I'm going to run on the surface of the water back home.
Oh, yeah. Tom Cruise is Dunkirk. It's him ferrying people over on his back using the power of Xenu. I was sitting there and I was... it was just a funny thing because they nailed Harry Styles and you go... Like, I guess an obvious one would have been, imagine if it was Justin Bieber or someone like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, do you have a favorite character in the movie?
Look, just for pure cool points, it's got to be Tom Hardy's.
It's like a Steve McQueen role.
Yeah. And the fact that he's so expressive, as he is as Bane, you know, with just the eyes and everything. And I think I appreciate it a lot more this time as well, being fully... You know, every time it would flip scenes, I was like, oh, okay, this is, you know, when it would go back to the beach, it's like, okay, this was 6 days ago from what we just saw with the planes. So having that more linear, being able to break apart the three stories in a linear way in my head made me appreciate Tom Hardy's performance a lot more. And something that we've mentioned about previous Nolan films released on Blu-ray, no sound issues. I could understand everything he was saying.
Yes. I'm starting to wonder if it is cinemas.
I reckon they remix the movies for the Blu-ray. I really do.
It's funny, there was a lot of research for this because it's factual as well, and we'll race through the squid bits part. But you know, his approach to sound is fascinating, and I think it is, like, I understand when people have issues with it, but I'm on his side and everyone's wrong.
I know. Yeah, we established that.
I'll stick by him. We're going through Nolan's Bowie 90s era where I maintain the rage. I won't do what you told me. I kind of love the Scottish pilot. I think there's something kind of really cool about him, and it is all that scene when he gets pulled out of the water and the way he's still kind of, come on, Ferrier, you know.
Yeah.
But Tom Hardy, it's funny. Every time someone turns up, you go, I think he's my favourite.
Yeah.
Oh, I think he's my favourite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Tommy is such a beautiful character. Yeah. Like that moment when he just goes straight to sleep and you go, oh, man, you fucking deserve this so much. Yeah. Even the look on his face at the end is like, I don't think it is sentimental because the look on his face is a very ambiguous one at that very last scene. The scene that most people would have finished on is the plane on fire. But going back to that boy, it just reminds you it's a story about very normal people, and there's a look of uncertainty because he doesn't know what the future holds for him or for all of them. Do you know what I mean?
It's not over. The speech that he just read is, we are continuing to fight.
Yes.
We are going to fight on the beaches and the landing grounds. And
yes. I've already told you that, that moment when Tom Hardy's like, you know, good luck. Can you hear me? And he looks and he sees the hand waving and goes, oh, he's okay. Yeah, goes off. And then you see it from the other and he's fucking panicking. You go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
At least Tom Hardy, while he spends 4 years in some horrible camp, can think his mate, knows his mate made it to safety, even if he doesn't quite know. Do you ever really want to see Tom Hardy's beautiful face in a movie again? Or do you just want him to always be masked?
He has the most expressive eyes in all of Hollywood.
Yeah. They're so beautiful. I love him so much.
Yeah.
Two more questions. George's death is, it's so tragic because no one asks you to be upset.
No, it's a very disposable event.
Yes.
Yeah.
When do you think you would have died in Dunkirk?
Oh, fucking, I would have fucking dug up someone's pistol and shot myself in the head. Like, I'm not that tied to life when it's great, let alone when there's fucking Spitfires zooming across. Are you fucking kidding me? This, like, live at all costs philosophy, I don't understand it. I'm more than happy to check out and be recycled back into the universe. I'm all good.
I have a...
This fucking bullshit.
You know how I told you that I snapped at my real estate agent last week, which is a story for... I don't know if I really want to share it with everyone, but I have been driven insane by my real estate agent and the fact that they are replacing a lift that's right next to my bedroom that they said will be 5 weeks, which I said will not be 5 weeks, and it starts at 7 a.m. and the noise here can be excruciating. Yeah. And so up until the email that I fired off after, for months, they did not follow through with their promises to ring and sort some things out. Up until that moment, I would like to have think that I would have landed the plane and I would have set it on fire and then I would have gone to camp and been very stoic.
Yeah.
But now I think I would have been the guy on the boat looking at the Scottish pilot going, where were you? Where's the bloody Air Force?
That would have been me. I would have snapped.
By the way, even right at the end, even the plane coming into land and he can't get the landing gear down, you're still going, Jesus Christ, what is happening here? Yeah. And final question, which I always ask you, would this work as a TV show?
No. It's got to be a hot shot.
It's got to be.
Got to be a hot shot because the power of this movie is the sustained anxiety attack.
Yes.
And that, again, is why it has to be a 90-minute movie. It can't be any longer.
And that's where I come in at the... I think this is technically the movie.
This is a obviously less violent, but this is an hour and a half of the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan. It's that pitch the whole way through of just... I'm just get me out of here.
Yes.
And I think if you went any longer, it would diminish that effect.
Yes.
And if you stretch it out of a series, well, it's an impossible tempo to maintain over a multi-episode thing.
Yeah.
So you would have to slow down, which then, no, it needs to be.
It is what it is.
I mean this in the best possible way. It is like a virtual reality experience or a theme park ride.
Yes.
Not theme park ride in the way Martin Scorsese describes Marvel movies. Theme park ride in the sense that it is an experience that most movies are not.
Yes, I agree. Or I'd be happy with 7 seasons of me having a nervous breakdown while watching 12. Oh, my God. So here are the squid bits for you. I've got some... once again, I've tried to... By the way, the makings of, which I'm not necessarily into with movies
for the most part.
They're
good on the
Blu-ray. Jeez. But the Dunkirk stuff is so fascinating. So Nolan and his wife were inspired to make the movie after they caught a boat to Dunkirk with a friend that hit rough seas and took longer than expected. They left England at 5 a.m. and arrived in Dunkirk at 1 a.m. Nolan said, "What really stuck with me from the experience was just how extraordinary the notion was of civilians taking small boats across these very difficult waters, knowing they are heading into a war zone." Mm-hmm. Emma Nolan said most war movies are made from the perspective of generals moving pieces around maps, but this is told from the very normal people's POV. It was shot on location. They attached the actual IMAX cameras to the planes. Mm. Like, did you see that? Yeah. Oh, so impressive, isn't it? It's like, because they're such big machines. Yeah. And the cinematographer, how do you pronounce his name? Hoytheimer. He's a bear of a man. And it's funny, like, did you see the bit where they shot some scenes like the boat sinking on the soundstage, and they're in this, you know, they fill up the water and he's in there and he's a bit like, ah, this isn't a challenge at all. And he's a bit disappointed. So I love that. What I also liked about watching the making ofs is that Nolan went up in the planes, he was in the water. He's really hands-on, isn't he? There. Which I don't think I quite realised. And there was, you know, the scene where they want to make the close-ups of the pilot in the cockpit. They rigged a fake plane cockpit, placed it on the edge of a cliff looking out at the Pacific Ocean. You can see scenes of Nolan moving it in the direction.
Oh, I didn't see that. Yeah, wow.
And it looks amazing. It looks like a ride. You know, but he's there moving, like, so many shots of him somehow still dressed in a suit in the water, but like waterproof suit. I love it.
He's the anti-Hitchcock. Apparently Hitchcock wouldn't even look through the viewfinder of the camera.
Oh, he'd just really?
Sit there adjacent to the camera and go, yes, you stand there. But he had this, you know, like, incredible filmic mind, but he was always just completely hands off.
Yeah. The RAF did have trouble providing cover due to the amount of fuel they could hold. Soldiers on the beach claimed they never saw the RAF in the skies. One pilot bailed over Dunkirk Beach, had to fight to get on a boat, and was back in the air the day after his return to England. As I said, I'd like to think that was me. Have a feeling. I'm like, where the fuck were you, mate? The RAF actually lost 145 planes in 9 days of fighting. The British did really hold back ships and planes with the fall of France, preparing for what came next. Kenneth Branagh's character seems to have been inspired by Captain William Tennant, who was on the scene and is credited with doing an astounding job of getting the soldiers to safety. He later fought the Japanese off Singapore, and his ship was sunk there. He survived and helped organize D-Day landings and even helped to lay an oil pipeline under the channel to fuel the invasion force.
You realize you don't even belong to the same species as these kind of people,
like,
right?
Well, I wrote these questions.
I got a train here in the final days of COVID.
Yeah. The pamphlets being dropped were real. They weren't colour.
Right.
But that's a little thing. Yeah, but that's all right. Some people have thought that the soldier striding out into the water is a bit on the nose, but that is something that actually happened. Witnesses tell of a man who dropped his gear and turned around and told all of those people that were around him that he was going to walk to England, while others had mental breakdowns and wandered off the beach.
Yeah, I didn't see that as arch at all. I thought that was completely relatable.
Yeah, so did I.
Have you ever had that illusion where you're walking on a long beach, like that full-on illusion of spatial illusion, where you're like, oh, I've just got to get to that ridge. And then all of a sudden, it's like an hour later and the ridge is further away than it's ever been.
Yes,
That's happened to me a couple of times and I've felt insane in that. Yes. Like, and, you know, I'm well-dressed, it's fine, it's the middle of the day, I'm not being bombed.
Yes.
And I felt out of my fucking mind. I can't even imagine what a week on an eternal stretch of beach would do to the
Jesus,
the brain.
I've had that performing at the Sydney Opera House. It's like, you know, because you don't want to race to the microphone because that is such a bad look. You just want to calmly walk out and you go and it's like, Jesus, this is a long way. So I can't even imagine what something important would be like. There were real moments when pilots did bail their planes near Royal Navy vessels or small boats to be rescued. Spitfires have been reported as gliding without petrol for as long as 15 miles or more. Churchill did want as many French soldiers saved as possible to help encourage them to continue the fight. There were fights, though, as the French were in such disarray because there was no policy about evacuation. And then eventually some French soldiers remained behind to cover the British soldiers while they escaped. The last line with Brannas staying behind to help the French implies they had their own Dunkirk. There was an effort that rescued 75,000 soldiers, but the vast majority who escaped returned to France when Germany occupied it because the country was no longer at war. So they did return, like, not that they liked the Germans, but it's no longer at war, we may as well go back.
Yeah, right.
What we don't see is that there were African soldiers from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia and elsewhere who helped delay the German attack. There are also four companies of the Royal Indian Army Service Corps on the beaches. While they only made up a few hundred amongst the thousands there, their service was indispensable and they continued fighting in North Africa and the Middle East. There are scenes where there's obviously some black Frenchmen and stuff like that. Yep. But it's I know that's a criticism, but I think I think I understand that you know how you said it's sometimes hard to keep up with who's who, and I think that's part of the reasoning that you have such a bland looking cast in many ways.
Yeah.
One in seven Allied soldiers who retreated to Dunkirk were captured and made prisoners of war. They were then marched to Germany and spent 4 years in camps. So not a fun ending for Farrier. And also suggests to me that Hogan's Heroes is not correct. On the opening day for Harry Styles, Nolan looked at him and knew he'd laced his boots incorrectly for the period. They had to rebuild the original mole and the elements there are so violent they'd often wake up to find parts of it smashed and washed out to sea. For some of the soldier extras, they took photos, printed them out so they were size appropriate, painted them, cut them out, stuck them to wire mesh for the long shots.
Yeah, very good.
So cool when you realise it. Because when you, like, knowing that, you're looking and going, they definitely look like people.
Yeah.
No use of green screens. There were no destroyer ships they could use, so they filmed smaller ships that looked appropriate and then just played with the scale to make them seem larger. So the score is essentially non-stop except for two moments, one after Harry Styles is saved from being crushed. And when Tommy goes to sleep, it just stops immediately. They use the shepherd tone audio illusion, which is a sound that creates the auditory illusion of a tone that seems to continually ascend or descend in pitch, yet which ultimately gets no higher or lower. Every time the movie was edited, they'd have to rearrange the whole audio landscape to fit the new version of the movie. There are no quick edits in the film. IMAX cameras allow the opportunity to linger and let the audience find the action.
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it? So you're not being told,
where to look.
I've got to be feeling this. You're just watching it and feeling it naturally.
Yeah.
Nolan reached out to Spielberg to prepare for making the movie. Spielberg sent him a print of Saving Private Ryan that had only been watched 12 times. Spielberg's advice was to put the research first and foremost to best tell the story of what happened on that beach. Nolan originally wanted to film the movie without a script because he felt he had an understanding of the scope and the movement of the story. His wife Emma looked at him as if he were insane and basically told him that wouldn't cut it. He turned around and wrote a 76-page script and wondered if he should double space it because it was so short. A lot of the film was made at Dunkirk and was also filmed during the anniversary of the operation, I think the 76th anniversary.
Yeah.
Michael Caine's voice is the commander on the other end of Tom Hardy's radio. He's the one who says, make sure you can still come home. And Nolan said it is a bit of a nod to his character in The Battle of Britain. 30 veterans of the battle said the noise in the movie is louder than what they expected, what they experienced, according to Branagh. And Branagh said this tickled Nolan to hear. He really enjoyed that. The reason the noise discrepancy is because on the beach, it's so vast that the noise dissipates.
Of course.
The veterans did agree.
Only Nolan would make a movie that's louder than an actual war, though.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It made me laugh even reading it. The veterans did agree that nearly everything else was almost exactly as they remembered, though. Harry Styles was cast mainly because he has an old-fashioned face, and Nolan remarked, "I don't think I was that aware, really, of how famous Harry was." There must have been a moment with his wife. It's like, look at this.
You know when you sometimes
think of these people and what their quiet moments are like, and it's probably them watching some clips going,
who is this One Direction?
The score by Hans Zimmer literally used the ticking of one of Nolan's watches. Nolan owns a watch with a particularly insistent ticking, so he recorded it and sent it to Hans Zimmer. They began building the track out of that sound. Nolan didn't think of Dunkirk as a war movie. He thought of it as a suspense film. And my final fact is, an RAF pilot probably wouldn't have been able to shoot down a dive bomber while gliding, but fuck everyone, that scene is super
great
cool.
Great scene. Come on.
Especially the moment when you think, oh my God, are they about to kill Kenneth Branagh?
And he surrendered to it as well.
And he surrenders. Mm. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Mm. You know. So, any last thoughts on Dunkirk? I feel like we covered everything.
Yeah, I think we did. And I definitely enjoyed it this time more than I ever have. Having a lot of that kind of initial panic out of the way and able to just kind of track the characters a bit more. And I do think it's not a movie I love, because movies that I love kind of I'm more of a fan of like linear narrative or, you know, big, bold character arcs and stuff. But it is a movie that, as I said, I enjoy as an experiential kind of like, you know, once every couple of years. Oh, yeah, let's fucking go there. Let's do that.
It's funny. I had a real urge to rewatch it as soon as I finished the script.
Yeah, right.
Like, I was like, oh, maybe I could just watch it again. It only goes an hour and 40 minutes. So, but it's funny, isn't it? Like, when you list his movies, and you like this movie for this reason, you like that movie, and Dunkirk kind of weirdly slips through the lists. Like, I think when I was on FOFOP with Will Anderson, I maybe had Dunkirk a bit lower, but I think I've done it a disservice, because I think it's
I think what it elicits from the viewer is it's such an extreme reaction that you need to, it's not something you're going to chuck on a Sunday afternoon to just have on in the background.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, it's similar to a lot of, you know, like a Lynch movie.
Yes.
You kind of got to be open to being taken to a place that isn't necessarily comfortable.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, and then that means we've got one more Nolan movie to cover.
Yeah.
And that will be Tenet, and that'll be fun because it'll be really extraordinary to talk about a movie that made $350 million, but Americans are still convinced wasn't a hit. Thank you to Ben Elwood for helping me dig into Dunkirk. That was a fun podcast, right? Feel like we found some new angles and some new thoughts about that movie. I was quite surprised at where it went, and I was the one who was writing all the questions. Anyway, you'll be able to see Ben in all his glory at our FOMUS show on December 13th. So if you come down to Giant Dwarf, please make a fuss of him. Let my good friend know how much you enjoy his work. He's very humble, and he gets a little bit embarrassed. So I would like him to receive some props, and I would also like to watch him being awkward while you're really nice to him. So remember, you can buy tickets for it in person or for the show online at giantdwarf.com.au. Tenet will be in a couple of weeks, but next week we're going to have Cal Wilson, and that's a fun podcast. That'll be an interesting one. I'll tell you more about that in the intro on that particular
particular show. Anyway, there's a bit of backstory to that one. But anyway, Cal Wilson's fantastic. Toby Hemingway, who's a writer and a singer-songwriter, he is going to be on talking about his new book and a little snippet of a conversation I had with Eliza Scanlon. She had just won Best Actor at the Actor Awards and she'd won for Baby Teeth, and I'd seen her in Sharp Objects and thought she was outstanding, and then I saw her in Baby Teeth and thought she was wonderful in that as well, and I was actually doing it as a favour for someone else, and then it was, you know, the audio probably goes for like 4 or 5 minutes or whatever, but she was so delightful, and I really liked her, and I thought she was just a really nice young person. You know, she's 22, and you just think, wow, look at all the talent you have now. I can't wait to see what you're doing in 10 years' time or 15 or 20. So I'll throw that in as well with a review of Baby Teeth, which is a wonderful Australian movie that if you get an opportunity, please check it out. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe if you haven't already. And if you do have time, if you can give us a nice rating and possibly a review on Apple Podcasts, that would be appreciated. I essentially produce this podcast on nothing but love, so any help is consistently appreciated. So thank you very much for that. Let's finish with a quote from Tom Hardy. I have to tell you, I love this quote. Some people don't understand that sitting in your own house, alone in peace, eating snacks and minding your business is fucking priceless. I don't think I've agreed with a quote more than this one. I hope you enjoyed that as well. Thanks for hanging out. Until then.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.